Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
Get us better away? Now, Charlie.
Welcome to Suplexes and Cervezas with Chavo Guerrero Jr. I'm your host, Chavo Guerrero Jr. Hey everybody, thanks for jumping on the podcast today. It's looking a little cloudy and overcast over here in Southern California. I'm always tooting the horn of what I believe is the greatest place on earth, Southern California, but today's looking a little cloudy and cold and kind of waiting for that sun to come back out. Was thinking today that I really love doing this podcast just because, man, I really get to talk with people that are my friends that I don't really get to see too much anymore, you know, living in a different place and not working in the same industry all the time. You know, you lose touch with a lot of people. So it's really cool to be able to actually get on this podcast and just, man, just talk about being on the road and just the times that we had and all the good times that we had with all of these guests. It's a lot of fun to catch up with my friends. It really is. I hope you're enjoying listening as much as I'm enjoying talking to them. And I was also thinking, God, what a really cool job. I'm sitting there in my own house, working when I want, basically, just enjoying something that I love to do. Doesn't get any better than this. I hope you're all enjoying your jobs and your lives also. It's something to strive for. I know we've all worked so hard to get to where we're at. And it's really cool just to be able to enjoy the fruits of your labor. So if you haven't made it to where you're at, keep pushing, keep going. You'll get there. Just perseverance and sacrifice. You'll get there. And something that I've definitely done and so much more to come for me. So it's a good life. Today on the pod, I have a good friend of mine, a guy that I've been in many different organizations with WWE and Lucha Underground, transitioning into Hollywood with Glow and some other TV shows and more to come for sure. But this is Marty Elias, was the senior referee at WWE, and we talk about how he made it there. Pretty cool, interesting story of how he really just had to want wrestling and no one was looking for him and nobody gave it to him. And he just, you know, kept pursuing it and kept trying and made it to the bigs, even refereeing one of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time. And some people think the best WrestleMania match of all time, The Undertaker versus Shawn Michaels. What a phenomenal match. I still get goosebumps thinking about that match. But Marty was the referee in that match that Shawn Michaels actually asked him to be in. And what a lot of people don't understand is that the referee can make or break your match. And especially a match of this high caliber at this location in WrestleMania, you really have to be the best at your job to be there. So for Marty to actually make it there is definitely a testament to him. Also talk about his time being at the Whiskey A Go-Go in L.A. and all the other places like the Troubadour and the Rainbow Room and all the places like that, because he was such a big rock and roll fan and how much rock and roll influenced his life. And just to hear all the bands that he's seen and the times that he's had at these little places and seeing these bands, these huge, massive worldwide bands, world-known bands, start off as really nobody except for people in the street knowing them, and getting the flyers from the actual band, handing out, you know, putting them on cars and telling everybody to come check out their show tonight at these little venues. So really, really cool, iconic for sure. And this is a guy who's made it to both the echelon in both of those businesses. So it's really cool. I hope you enjoyed this talk with one of my really good friends, Marty Elias, WWE referee, rock and roll, roadie, and groupie. And it starts right now. Everybody, thanks for joining in today. Today we have my boy, ex-WWE referee, ex-Lucha Underground referee, ex-Glow referee. We got you all over the place and current, always a metal fan, Marty Elias, my boy. What's going on, brother?
How you doing, man? Thank you for having me here, Chavo. Good morning, man. And
man.
Bro, I'm excited to do this, man.
We've been talking about it. Huh? We've been talking about doing this a little bit, but
We've been talking for a minute.
Yeah, man. That's what I love about doing this podcast is I really get to catch up with all my boys, you know, and girls and, shoot the shit, stuff that we wouldn't necessarily do all the time, you know? So
yeah,
it's kind of cool, you know? So it's cool to do this thing.
Absolutely, man. Looking forward to it. And you know what, dude, I'm going to ask you straight up. Is anything off limits? Is there anything you want to talk about? Anything that's taboo or whatever? Because, you know, you and I can, you know.
You're not kidding. Nothing is off limits. Yeah, I should be asking you that. Is anything off limits? But no, nothing's off limits, man, for me. But
no, dude, you know me, man. I'm easy, man. You know, one of these guys, you know, that I don't say much. But when I do, man, I make it count, so to speak.
No, for sure, man. For sure, dude. I appreciate that. That's why I think why I like you and why I don't.
Thank
like
you. Yeah. And that's why, you know, you and I are putos.
That's it, man. Hey, man. So, dude, growing up, man, you know, you've been in the wrestling game, but were you a wrestling fan growing up?
Yeah, I actually started watching professional wrestling because my little brothers used to watch it. And mom and dad, when my dad got out of prison,
yeah,
they would go work odd jobs and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so what they would do is they would go work on the weekends and stuff. And my little brothers were little fucking brats, and Robert and Ruben. So they wouldn't behave. And the only thing that calmed them down and what got their attention was putting on professional wrestling.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So me being the older brother and the babysitter and stuff, I had to actually sit there and watch it with them because this was the only thing that calmed them down. Mm. And from sitting there those times and those days and stuff and everything, I just started getting ingrained with it and started, wow, this is cool, man. This is. And then when I turned 18, I had my first car. And I started taking my brothers to the LA Sports Arena and I started taking them to a bunch of independent stuff around here. And it just started progressing for me. And when I went to my first live event, there was something about the magic of it, man. Just the whole environment, man. Just the electricity of it. No pun intended. But it was something that just grabbed me and told me that I could do this. I could do this. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew that I could do this because music was always my first love, as you know.
Right, right.
And I always wanted to be in KISS, but that never happened because I was a poor Mexican, you know, on welfare and food stamps. So that wasn't going to happen. So I started getting ingrained with professional wrestling, started loving it, and I started following people, and I just started watching it, started collecting all the VHS tapes and reading all the magazines and all that other good stuff that, you know, that you do, especially back then, pre-internet and pre-everything that we know today. So, you know, I was trading tapes with people and just looking for anything that I could find, and it just started happening. And then I actually reached out to Paul Roma, who is my compadre. You know, and I hit him up and I said, hey, I said, are there any wrestling schools that you know about?
Paul Roma and, from the old, was worthy the young
Power and Glory, Power and Glory. Yeah.
Him and, what was it? The
Hercules.
G Jim Powers, Young Stallions, that's when I first saw him in WWE. Paul Roma, and also became a four horseman for a minute there.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And then Paul ended up tagging with Paul Orndorff from Pretty Wonderful.
That's right. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's got some tag team partners. That's right. I forgot about
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, and it was cool because I got to hang out with Paul back then and really get to and it's funny because the way I met Paul is I actually was a fan. And again, I would always go and I would always be there. And it's like, hey, I'm here again. You know, so every time wrestling was around, I was always showing up. So Paul took a liking to me and we just became friends, man. And ultimately, this was here in California. Like Cali. Every time they would come around or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, I would always show up and stuff. And for some godforsaken reason, I would always end up running into Roma and we just became buds and, you know, he befriended me and, you know, we started hanging out all the time. And then, in August of 91, I went out to New York and I, baptized his daughter for him, you know, and,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's been cool. And, for me, it was just getting ingrained with what they were doing and stuff. And back then, everything was a lot more kayfabe and stuff. You know, you're talking late 80s, early 90s, man. And, you know, so even though I was backstage, I had all the long hair and all that shit. Nobody really gave me, you know, a hard time because they knew that I was one of Roma's guys. But I wasn't, you know, that mark or whatever. I was just a long haired guy hanging out with Roma. You know, and it was cool because I got to meet a lot of the boys back then and they were always cool to me, man. They were always cool to me and they didn't treat me like a mark, which was really, really something, you know, that I appreciate, especially now me knowing what I know today and stuff and being part of the business that they really, you know, took a liking to me and I wasn't treated as a mark.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. Who trained you? How'd you get in the business? How'd you decide? So now becoming a mark backstage, not a mark, but actually,
we're all marks.
You know, you have to be in this business,
yeah.
But who'd like, when you finally decided like, hey, you know what? I want to make this little leap and see if I can do this. Where'd you go?
I actually, Paul suggested that I go to Jesse Hernandez.
Jesse, because I've known Jesse. Brother,
you know? So, Paul suggested Jesse Hernandez because, mind you, Jesse was a freelance referee back in the day in the 80s and stuff for them, you know, and Jesse would always work with them and stuff. So all the boys knew Jesse because Jesse would do all the West Coast stuff and everything. And plus, you know, he was with Mike LaBelle and everybody when they and dude, I'm going deep now. Yeah, so
Olympic auditorium and stuff. That's how we got.
Yeah.
My dad started working with Mike LaBelle at the Olympic, yeah.
And that was cool, man, because I would go to the Olympic and see stuff and everything, too. So I knew Jesse. I would see Jesse. And then when Roma suggested that I go to Jesse, you know, that's when I ultimately found out where he was and stuff. And I went to San Bernardino and literally his training place. And I'm sure you were there. It was that room. It was maybe 12 feet by 12 feet, a ring barely fit in there. And there was holes in the ceilings, holes on the side of the walls, because when you hit the ropes, your elbow would hit the or whenever you were going to suplex somebody or whatever, feet would go through the roof and stuff. So it was such a cool vibe back then because it was so old school. And
there was no big, huge, like training centers, like what the performance centers like WWE has now. It was wrestling back in the day when you wrestled, you got trained in an old warehouse or a backyard that's the way it was back then. So you're saying
and it was dirty. It was grimy.
Yeah.
And it stunk. It was raw and dirty. And like you said, it's nothing like what everybody trains in today. You know, it was completely different and it was rough and it was old school. And one of the things, you know, that I really appreciated, and I know you and I have had these conversations, is that we were tough. Because they weeded us out and they weeded people out back then, because if you couldn't hang, then you weren't going to be allowed in the business or around to do any shows or do anything. So they would literally beat the shit out of you to see what you were made of.
Yeah.
And if you couldn't hang, bye.
That very, very true. Like they didn't want to train you. They almost wanted to take your money and then not train you. But then all of a sudden, like they wanted only like the top of the top, the tough people who could actually handle this business, especially back then, and not to compare now to them, it's totally different times, but back then it was just different. It was like the Wild West. And if you you really had to want it back then, like, because I hate to compare, because it's two different things. It's apples and oranges, both fruit, but two totally different things. Back then, there was like those nice training facilities, you know, like, you know, the WWE Performance Center. So nice, man. It's like, I'm at like a this beautiful training center, like almost an NFL training center thing.
It's almost a resort is what it is.
Yeah. It's awesome. I'm happy. I'm totally happy that wrestling has come that far. But, you know, it's almost a pleasure being there. So when you were back in the day training in an old warehouse and driving an hour or 2 hours just to get there and, you know, paying money and eating a freaking hot dog or, you know, the fruit on the side of the road just to eat, it's because you really wanted it. You really had to want wrestling. They weren't looking at you. They weren't like scouting you. That's not how wrestling was back then. It was like, hey, you want to be a wrestler? Okay, here, pay your $3,000 and I'll try to train you. And then hopefully I don't have to train you. Just take your money.
Yeah. And it was funny because they would get the $3,000 for you. And then they would hope that you would quit after one session, man. And they would just take all that $3,000, you know, and that happened a lot, by the way, you know? Absolutely. So, but yeah, and it's funny too. And again, no comparison to then to today, but back then you had, and even when we were on the road and stuff and we were running and all that, there's a difference today. And I'll say this as honest as I can, and it's nothing against anybody, is that back then they were tough guys and there were men who were doing this, you know? And I know there's a lot of kids today doing this and everything. And unfortunately, I really don't think a lot of these kids would have been able to endure what we endured, unfortunately. And it's nothing against them. It was just a whole different time. And when we were rolling and stuff, it was more about being one of the boys and protecting the business, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, too, and one, I say that a lot, like back in the day, there wasn't MMA. There wasn't UFC. No. There wasn't that stuff. Like no one really knew about that stuff. It's either if you're a tough guy and you still wanted to be in a tough guy business, you either try to be a pro boxer or you became a bouncer or you became a pro wrestler. It's like there wasn't a lot of avenues. Now, you know, guys like, I'm a good fighter, so I'm going to try UFC or I'm going to try, you know, jiu-jitsu or whatever. That wasn't really, not that it wasn't around. They just didn't do that back then, you know? No. So like tough, good, like you had to be extremely tough to be in pro wrestling. I don't even know if I could have made it back in the day, like my dad's era and stuff. Cause it was,
tough. Yeah, man.
They were so tough. And not to compare, I don't want to be one of those guys that's always like comparing nowadays. Well, in my day, you know, we walked uphill and, you know,
back in the day
in the snow. And, but I do see a difference, and I see the difference in just like the mental toughness of all of these, the wrestlers back then to now for the most part. So I don't want to, you know, there's still tough guys out there. Don't get me wrong. But you know, compare and, you know, people ruffles people's feathers, whatever, it is what it is. But it's like saying, you know, football, you know, back in, you know, in the '60s when you could hit the quarterback, and, you know, in the '40s when they weren't wearing face masks, it probably was a little tougher than it is now with concussion and stuff. And it's probably a good thing we've moved this way, but definitely back in the day, they were, those, they were men, you know?
Yeah. And that was the thing.
Remember what Undertaker said when he said, like, dude, we were in the locker room and most every one guy had a knife in his boot because, you know, things were going to go down, you know, things would happen.
Yeah.
In a different time.
And that was the thing, like when you and I were rolling on the road and whatever, dude, that we were always down for a fucking brawl or whatever. When we would go out or whatever, dude, it was always on because you just never knew.
There were no cell phones and there weren't no people getting sued for that. You got to fight and you're hitting people or trying not to get stabbed and you're running out of the bar. And
the thing is, too, you know, you may have got your ass whooped once or twice, but you live to fight another day, man.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, totally. That's funny. It's cool to see that when I talk to people like that, they're still from that era because it's lost, you know, things aren't the same as they were there. And it's a good thing that it's changed because of, you know, cell phone cameras and things that you shouldn't be able to get away with. But at the same time, I think everybody's so, we're so soft now, you know, I mean, all of us, you're just so like, you know, oh, I'm going to sue you. Back then it was like, hey, you got a problem, go outside and let's fight, you know,
or go in the shower stall.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you know? Totally. Go fight back there. Yeah, totally.
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
So from there, so now you got trained, Jesse, started paying your dues a little bit. You started doing indies and stuff?
Yeah, I started doing all the indies that I could up and down California. And mind you, there wasn't many indies to do because, you know, a lot of people weren't running in independents like that. You know, it was a lot of spot stuff and everything. So I really started working primarily for Jesse. And then ultimately when I started, you know, getting a little bit more experience and stuff, I started working for different guys. As a matter of fact, I worked for Bill Anderson, who was Melissa Anderson, cheerleader Melissa. He started booking me. Yeah, he started booking me. And it's funny because people confuse him with Bill Anderson and Jesse Hernandez. Sure. But Bill was a promoter like in the Bakersfield area and stuff. And Bill took a shine to me.
Are they different guys?
Yeah, different guys, different guys.
I knew Bill Anderson. There was a wrestler with Jesse, and there was another.
Yes. And there's another Bill Anderson. And Bill Anderson, cheerleader Melissa Anderson, that was her dad, and he was booking up like in Bakersfield, Fresno area. So he knew Bill and Jesse. And, you know, so he took a shine to me and he started booking me up on his shows. And again, you do the drives to Fresno and Bakersfield and stuff, you know, back then, I mean, it was really going in. And I remember, I made maybe $20 and had to drive maybe 3 hours to Fresno for $20.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. You know? You didn't do it for the money. You did it because you loved it and you wanted to like just advance yourself. And there was no guarantee like, oh, I want to try to make it to WWE. This is what you did on the side. And it was kind of like you loved it because you just loved doing it.
Yeah. And that was the thing too. There wasn't any, you know, recruitment stuff. There wasn't any scouting. There wasn't anything like that. It was all word of mouth, man. And your reputation perceived you, man, or preceded you. And that was the thing. It was a lot tougher to get back in the business back then. And again, kayfabe was still alive and well back then. So if they didn't feel that you belonged, then, you know, you weren't going to get booked and, you know, people weren't going to, you know, help you. And, you know, that's, I think, a major difference today too, is there's so many resources out there now for kids and people who want to get into the business, you know, that it's cool, you know, and, you know, like you and I have helped train people and help people out and stuff, but it was different back then. And again, no comparison to today because it's night and day, but it was just a whole different time back then. And I'm really, really humbled and honored that I was able to get that tail in and be a part of the old school, because that's who we are, bro.
No, for sure. No, I'm with you on that. Now you went from, how did you get, let's jump forward. How'd you get the call to WWE? How did that come about?
I would bug the shit out of these guys.
That's a whole nother universe. That's like being in a
whole nother universe.
That's like being on Earth and going to Mars.
Especially back then.
Yeah.
You know? There was no emails. There wasn't any of that bullshit. It was all tapes. It was all whatever, you know, and if you knew somebody and that was a thing, if you didn't know anybody, you weren't going to go anywhere. And that was the thing. So I actually started sending tapes to all the promotions, WCW, ECW, WWF at the time. I remember sending stuff to JJ Dillon. I remember sending stuff to JR. I mean, I remember sending stuff to Paulie. I remember sending stuff to Bischoff and all these guys who were there. And I just started letting people know who I was and stuff. And dude, I would literally make like handmade resumes and stuff and photos. What I would do is I would take a photo on a laptop or whatever, and then I would go cut and paste it and stuff. And dude, it was crazy the stuff that you had to do back then to really get, because there was no social media, there was no Photoshop, there wasn't any of that stuff. You know, if you had a photo and you had a tape and everything, you had to snail mail it and all that. And then when you mailed it off, you weren't guaranteed that they even got it, because more times than not, you know, when you know what you know now, it's like they probably looked at it and threw it in the trash, man.
Absolutely. You really, there was no like, did they, you know, click on my YouTube link and then, oh, I can see who clicked on it and who didn't know. Back then it was like you sent the VHS tape and that's probably the last you heard of it, you know, you throw it away, basically. Yeah.
And there wasn't any social media or blue check marks where people could go look at your matches and all that good stuff, you know, none of that stuff, you know. And it's crazy because today, you know, people are always uploading their matches and look at me and this and that and everything. It was like, all right, different times, man, but I'm glad I was there.
Oh yeah. No, totally. Totally. So you're bugging the heck out of these guys. And
yeah. So I started bugging these guys forever, man. And mind you, once I started figuring out who I needed to call and stuff, I actually called information one time, Stamford, Connecticut, and I got the number to WWF offices and stuff, because I what I would do is I would look on the back of the VHS tapes and everything, and I would look to see what the company was or where the company was at. Main Street, Stamford, Connecticut. Oh, okay, so I would find the address, whatever. So then I would call information. Can I have the number to WWF? And that's how I got the number to WWF, dude. So then I started calling, and I started telling them, hey, I'm Marty Rubicaba, I'm referee, blah, 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 leave messages, you know, all that good stuff. You there?
Yeah. You just went upside down. Yeah, totally. No, you went upside down again. I don't know why, but whatever. I totally know what you mean. Like I had, when I first started trying to break in, I got Paul Lee's number from Eddie, and I was training in El Paso with Eddie, living out there training for wrestling. Literally, I'd call Paul every single week and leave a message. And, you know, he wouldn't call me back every week. I kept calling and kept calling. I probably called him 30 different times. I felt bad because I kept leaving a message every time. You know, eventually the guy's going to call me back. And when I started in WCW and had my first debut match, that's when he called me back.
Wow. Yeah. See, and dude, it's crazy because I actually bugged him so much. And then, but here's the thing too, man, with Roma and stuff, Roma was trying to get back into WWF at the time and stuff after his WCW run and stuff. So it was, I believe, early 96, I believe, I actually hooked up with Roma and we did some WWE tryout matches, actually for WWF back in the day. Him and a guy who was his cousin, they were called the Pretty Primos, and I was called Mr. Ruby. So we went out to New York and New Haven and stuff, and we did some dark matches. And, you know, so I was doing dark matches for WWF back 96, 97, man. So
as a
manager, I was Mr. Ruby, man. So Mr. Ruby. So you know, I did that, and it was fun, man. It was fun. It was exciting. I was greener than green, man. Sure, had no clue, and it was funny because I had no idea how this worked. So when Roma said that we had dark matches and stuff, and they were going to fly me out, I quit my job. I quit my job because I was getting signed to WWF, man. So I quit my job. God. Quit I had no idea. I had no idea about anything. Quit my job and stuff. And then I came back home and I waited and I didn't hear anything. And, you know, okay, don't have a job. What's going on? So I would call Roma. He didn't know. So then finally, about after 6 months of this, Cornette finally called and says, we don't got a job for y'all.
You did have a job?
Okay. Didn't have a job. Cornette called.
Didn't have a job.
Yeah, Cornette called and goes, don't have a job for y'all. Oh, shit. What do I do now? You know, had to go get a job, man. So it's funny. Wow. You learn these lessons. And here's the thing, too, is that I didn't know that you got paid for dark matches. I didn't know you got the $200 draw. I didn't know anything about that. And I never got paid. So, you know, that.
Oh,
that
you never
cool.
got paid for it.
Never got paid for it, man. And there you go, green stuff and, you know, not knowing. But it was funny, too, because one of the things
back in the day, that was cash. That was like under the table. Cash. And yeah.
And sometimes that cash, that draw was the only thing you got.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And so it was funny because one of the things that I do remember vividly is that somebody ribbed me and they put two padlocks on my suitcase.
I remember that.
And that was great. And you know what? I didn't put it over, man. I just packed my bag, walked out, didn't say a word about it.
That was back in the day. They used to do this when they'd everybody would carry padlocks, and you know, just to keep themselves sane on the road by ribbing each other, is that they would, when you didn't know it, they would put, you know, just a padlock on your luggage. So you got guys, you know, waiting at the airport and just kind of hanging out, and we'd always wait till like the last ones to get on the plane, and we're just sitting there, and then all of a sudden, like, they have like a duffel bag and be sitting on the ground, and they'd padlock their duffel bag to the seat. And all of a sudden, okay, let's go, let's jump on. And all of a sudden, you're oh my God. So you had to rip your, just to get on the plane, you had to rip your
dude, that's funny you say
bag
that.
And a half, man. Just to get there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, and it was funny, you know, that, and then the fact that if you did put it over, they would do it more. You know,
yeah. Oh,
just,
no, totally.
Just to get you. Just to
that's
get
the
you.
Thing back. You couldn't, we call it sell it. You couldn't sell it. You couldn't put over their, you couldn't register basically their rib on you. Cause if once you did, it was like sharks in the water and people would be like, okay, this guy doesn't like, you know, like, you know, if somebody was like a bodybuilder guy and would, and they're always asking, hey, you know, how do I look? And you know, these guys look amazing. And they're like so insecure sometimes. And we'd see him in the gym and be like, you know, we see him worked arms and I'd be like, hey man, what's going on? Did you stop working arms or what's going on? What are you talking about, Charlie? I mean, your arms look a little small. Oh, I'm sorry. I was a sensitive subject. I'm sorry. And then someone else would say it and someone else would say it. And these guys would like have mental breakdowns because
those guys took it seriously.
Yeah.
Hey, bro, you eating right? You know?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah. Did your gym close down? We used to do that stuff all the
time. And it's funny because guys were sensitive about that, man.
Oh yeah.
Sensitive about that, especially back then, you know, because that's what it was.
Right, totally. So how did you finally get the job at WWE? Who finally called you?
Tommy Dreamer actually called me, man. And because he had just gotten into the office back then.
Right.
And again, mind you, dude, I was doing all the independents. I went to Japan with Jiro One and Hashimoto and Mexico. Oh, okay. And I went to Germany on my own stuff.
You had some appearance. You had some experience.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, man. And I started working everywhere I could. And then before WWE, what I did is I went from Bill and Jesse and everything. And then when Rick Bassman and UPW started and they started doing what they were doing, I went to go work for them and stuff. And then ultimately, you know, I started getting a lot of experience with that. And then I started getting involved with stuff behind the scenes with Bassman and stuff. So I started writing his shows for him and booking for him and stuff. And, you know, that's when, you know, Prototype came in, Lisa Marie came in, John Cena. Yeah.
Prototype. Yeah. Totally. Lisa Marie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mike Knox was back then.
Mike Knox. Yeah. Nathan Jones, John Heidenreich.
Yeah. Navajo Warrior.
Yeah.
Yeah. All those guys. So, yeah. And that was a good crew back then.
Man. It was, man. It was. And, you know, I remember, you know, Bassman would run the Galaxy and shows like that. I remember you and Ray Ray showed up, DDP, right. Conan, you know, so all these things were happening. And then it was great, you know, to be working with guys like that and learning and stuff. So before I got the call from WWE, again, I was bugging those guys, but I was trying to do dark matches and stuff, which I did. So my first referee dark match that I ever did was in 2000 for WWF, and it was at the Pond in Anaheim. And I went and I did it, and I came back through the curtain, and I was up in Gorilla, and Earl Hebner was sitting there, and he turns and he looks at me and he goes, "Your counts are too damn fast," and he walked away.
Okay, that's it.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks. So, you know, that was it. But again, knowing what I know now, I know why Earl did it, you know?
Sure. And then, so then you got a dark match?
Got the dark matches and stuff. And then what happened was, is that Tommy would call me and before I even had a deal. And of course they test you or they tested you back then is what they did is they started putting me on the road and they started putting me in different scenarios. I would go fill in for SmackDown. I would fill in for Raw. I would fill in for different things when referees were taking time off, whatever. So they started flying me out to different places around the country. And whenever they were in California, they would call me and I would go and I would fill in for people and stuff. And matter of fact, I remember working with you and Eddie at the Staples Center. It was you and Eddie against, I believe it was Rhino and Sean O'Hara.
Oh, wow.
Sean O'Hara. Dude, yeah. And that was fun. That was fun, bro.
I don't even remember
that. Yeah. Yeah. It was a Staples Center, bro. And and again, even though I've been kicked in the head 10,000 times too, man, it's cool because I remember those moments that mean something to me, man. And that was special to me because I was this guy trying to make it and stuff. And I got to work with you guys and, you know, it was really like things really just made sense then working with you guys.
Yeah. You had to be on. And when you're working with us, man, we were like a machine back then. Just go.
Yeah.
And we used the referees all the time. And what people don't realize in wrestling today, your referee, that's your third or your fifth person in the ring, depending on if it's a singles or a tag team. But that I use the referee so much when I'm in the ring. Like I always tell, yeah, I'm communicating through you, so you better be ready, you know? And people, a lot of wrestlers too, like now they're like, they like don't even know who the referee is. Like the referee is so important of the match. I mean, they really do make that match.
Yeah, and that's the thing, man. It was so great being in those matches with you guys and being able to work and learn, because you guys were just so good at what you did and stuff. And I remember even getting to WWE and stuff, you know, it was like, catch us.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Catch us.
We tell you guys, yeah, we tell the referee, if you could catch us cheating, then catch it, then catch us, because we were so good at doing it behind your back, and that we would never do it in front of you. Anytime you turn your back, we would do stuff that we would tell them, if you can catch us, then catch us, disqualify us. But you know, that's on us.
Yeah, but you know, it was great because you guys protected us too, man. Yep. You guys always protected us and knew, because you guys knew how to work, you know, and you guys were working with us.
Our big thing, me and Eddie, and still to this day, anytime I'm in the ring, is that you never want your heat. You're the one working in the ring. You never want your heat to go to the referee. When the fans are yelling, referee, you're blind. That means that the referee's getting the heat and the heel's not. So that's why we were always like, we want them to say, referee, turn around. Like, oh my God, these Guerreros are so sneaky and assholes that the referee can't even catch them. Then the heat's on us. But so much times you have the referee, you know, with his back turned like for like 5 minutes, and you're like, turn around, ref. Oh my God, wrestling's not real, because this referee's really not turning around. But we would do it so fast and so quick that even some of the crowd would miss it, because you had to, you know. But we do it so often, but eventually they'd see it. Yeah,
and that was the thing too, because whomever you guys were working with too, they would be my eyes and they would help. So stuff would go down, boom, 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 and then get turned, you know, or Marty turn, or you know, it was like that fast, man.
Right.
And I don't think guys have the ability to do that today, because they're so concerned about being on TV and, oh my God, missing a spot and stuff, that everything back then just flowed. And even like when you and I work together, I mean, if you and I were working right now, we just, what's a finish, Chavo? And then everything else, you know, like we say, it would be Shakespeare, brother.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I don't know. Like, what's a finish? I don't know.
We'll figure it out as we go, bro. All right, have fun.
Just count to three. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it, man. And I think that's a lost art form today. I really do.
Yeah, it definitely is. Wrestling definitely changed and evolved. Like anything, evolves and changes. So, you know, but I do think that there's getting less and less people out there that's able to teach that. Now it's like a lot of, you know, moves and spots and stuff, which is fine. It's different things, but that's just a different way of working, you know?
Yeah. And it's funny you say that about training and stuff, because I mean, I'll call it out. You know, you call things as they are. I mean, you and I should be somewhere training people. I humbly believe that, man, because of the experience we have and what we do and in our careers and stuff and our body of work and stuff. But, you know, if that's not the case, we're still happy and we're still doing stuff. But you and I have resources.
I'm good. I don't want to go training. And we're good, anybody, man.
You know,
it's too much work, man.
Yeah, but. Yeah. My point is that you and I have been able to move on from that and really do some cool shit, you know, but at the same time, just like you said, there people aren't training the way they were and everything, but you and I have those skills to do it. And we've proved it.
No, I agree with that. Totally.
Yeah.
So now you get the job at WWE. Now you're working for them. You're on the road, you're going, you know, you're traveling all over the world, doing your thing. And then you end up being the referee at WrestleMania, a main event WrestleMania with Undertaker and Shawn. How the heck was that?
Yes.
I mean, because so there's very few times too, like with as more experience you get, the more, the longer you're in the business, that the guys that you would just always watch and learn from start dropping off and start, you know, retiring and leaving. And so at this point now, there was, you know, not a whole lot of people that I would sit there and just watch and learn from. But this is one of those matches that, gosh dang, man, Taker and Shawn, WrestleMania, you know, they had two in a row, just so amazing. Like we were just watching these guys go, and what a story. It was just so amazing. And then you're right there. Tell me about that.
Yeah. And I always like to say that I earned that.
Yeah,
because of everything that I did up until that point and stuff with all
they wouldn't just put a random referee up for a WrestleMania match, any WrestleMania match, but especially the main event in WrestleMania. No, and I don't care whether they were the last match or not, they were the main event of WrestleMania. Whether they're second to last match or third last match, they were the main event. Because just you couldn't beat them. That you couldn't out storytell those guys. So they'd only put the best of the best in there with them. And if they didn't, you know, right away Taker and Shawn would say, we don't want this guy in there, you know.
Yeah, and I like to tell this story when people ask, is that Charles Robinson was originally the assigned referee for that match, like 3 weeks out. And I have a pretty good relationship with Shawn Michaels, I like to say. Yeah. And he and I traveled a lot and stuff, and I got to work with him a lot. And I got to learn from him, man. And
Yeah, he's a book of knowledge for sure.
Yeah, and, you know, so driving him, traveling with him, flying with him, I mean, I got to pick his brain and stuff. And at the same time, Ricky Steamboat was my agent for a lot of stuff too. Mm-hmm. So Steamboat and I would work on a lot of stuff, man, all the time. And that's what a lot of people don't figure out and stuff, because I mean, I'm going to say it point blank. I'm the greatest referee who's not on TV. You know, I learned. Thank you.
Well, look who you're learning from. You're learning from two of the best of all time telling you. Yeah. Don't do this, do that. Because those guys use the referee all the time. They understood the importance of the referee in that match. And
yeah,
for anybody listening, a referee, like, we get it, sports entertainment, and it's, you know, whatever, it's not, you know, really fighting in there. But that referee is essential in helping you tell your story. So a referee can make or break your match, like I said before, but...
Yeah,
really, really, so essential to help tell your story by catching you cheating, by not catching you cheating, by turning at the right time, by just being a part of that story. So you have two of the best of all time, Shawn Michaels, Ricky Steamboat, teaching you this. I mean, and then other ones, Finley and Arn Anderson, and
you know,
all the guys. I mean, God, so many of the agents, Dean Malenko and Mike Rotundo and everybody that was there that were agents at the time that were sitting there and teaching you. I mean, it was like the top level of wrestling in the world.
Dude, I got to learn from Eddie. I got to learn from Chris Benoit, man.
Absolutely.
I mean, and I got to learn from Flair. I got to learn from all these guys. I got to learn from Vince, dude. Yeah. And that's the thing, man. I would always ask. I always wanted to be the best that I could be, man. And and I did ultimately, you know, start getting really good. And and that's why, you know, I was placed in a lot of these high profile matches, because they knew. And Shawn even told me, man, he goes, the reason why I wanted you in that match with me and Taker is because I knew that there was going to be three guys in that match who wanted to be there, and we're going to make it happen. And we did. We made magic.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Good man.
No, for sure. That's some of the best matches of all time right there. We just talk about those two in a row that they had. They were so good. They were just like a masterpiece in wrestling, a masterpiece in storytelling. If you haven't seen those matches, go back and see what WrestleManias were they?
WrestleMania 25 and WrestleMania 26.
I mean, just amazing matches. And that's how you tell a story, by not just using moves to tell a story, but actually telling a story. And they got everybody to believe what they're doing. It's amazing. They really is.
Yeah. And what was really cool about that is, you know, of course, being asked, you know, to referee from Shawn Michaels. I mean, that was my defining moment, man. And it was something that I worked my ass off to get to.
Right.
And being a part of that history, I mean, the greatest match in WrestleMania history is what many people consider it.
Yeah.
I'm honored by that, man. And if that's what people remember me for in my career, you know, I'm okay with that, man, because, you know, I got to that very top of the mountain, man. I got to work at the top of Mount Everest, man, and I got to work with two of the greatest ever. And just those guys alone in their individual careers, man, I mean, but just to be in there with both of them at the same time and do what we did, it was something that I'll never forget, man. Even though I've had some really other great moments and stuff, dude.
Yeah, that's
that right there to me was the pinnacle of everything that I had ever worked for and stuff. And people remember it. And I'm honored by that. And I'm humbled that people do like that match and they bring it up and stuff. But it was something, you know, that I worked my ass off to get and achieve. And, you know, that's what you work for. It wasn't about the money. It wasn't about being famous. It was about being able to be one of the greatest workers ever and stuff. And, you know, I was one of the greatest referees ever. So like you said, there was three great guys in that match and we made magic and we made history, man.
Anytime you see that match, you're going to see two people in the ring and then you three people right there. So that's
absolutely
pretty awesome.
Absolutely, man.
So then you get there, you're basically the pinnacle of wrestling.
You're
refereeing WrestleMania main events and you're up there. You've been a senior referee. And then what happened? The infamous Kiss t-shirt.
Dude, I found that shirt in storage about 2 weeks ago. It was crazy. So, I actually got it right here.
So at WWE, they instated a dress code. So at a certain time, they wanted us to all dress business casual. And here, let me clear myself real quick. So, hold on.
Yeah, hold on. Let me get a charger real quick, bro.
All right, go ahead. Hold on, John.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I smoke another one.
Yeah, right. Too early for that.
Yeah. Cool. Charge? Yeah. So
okay,
yeah, charge,
so, okay,
bro.
Okay, John, we're back. So WWE they installed a dress code, and anywhere you travel, we have to have like in business casual. So anytime we're going to work, I mean, on the plane, going to the airport, getting in the rental car, they wanted us like, you know, in dress, you know, pants and, you know, nice shoes and a nice collared shirt.
Collared shirt.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and belt and stuff, you know, shirt tucked in. They wanted you dressing like, you know, like a professional. So there we are. And we'd get fined if you weren't dressed like that. If they saw you out, you know, in, you know, with a t-shirt, like on a flight, you're not representing the company correctly. So you'd get fined at times. So then.
Yeah. So what happened was, is we were over in Europe for a couple of weeks, and you know, those long tours, you go through clothes, you go whatever. So we come back to the States.
We'd be in Europe sometimes for like a 3 week tour, and we'd be in 21 different cities, 8 different countries in 3 weeks. Like literally we would go from town to town to town to town, and we would stay one night in a hotel, and sometimes not even after the show, we'd jump on a bus and get to the next town. So, I mean, it was go, go, go. No chance to do laundry. You couldn't.
You were on the road, man. And that's right. The thing with people, when I hear people, oh man, I've been on the road. No, you haven't.
Right.
No, you haven't. You know, we were on the road, bro.
No, for sure. And
so we came back and we were in DC, and the only thing that I had clean was a Kiss t-shirt. So I was in ballet. I was getting my car and I had slacks on. I had dress shoes on. And unbeknownst to me at the time, Kevin Dunn and Johnny Ace were waiting in a limo. They were waiting for Vince. So Kevin Dunn seen me and he goes, "Hey, John, Marty's out of dress code. What are you going to do about it?" And I didn't know that. So I get to the building. I do my stooge duty where I check people in. You know, which I hated that, but they always delegated that to the referees, all the shit work. So, so I did that and I went into catering after I did it and I was wearing my slacks, my shirt, and I had the Kiss t-shirt on. And I come into catering and it's John Laurinaitis, Mark Carano, and Kevin Dunn. So I'm sitting there and Johnny's sitting and he's eating and he looks at me and he throws down his fork and he goes, "Marty, what the fuck you doing? You got a Kiss t-shirt on." I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Don't you know we have a fucking dress code?" "Yeah, John, sorry, man. What are you doing with a fucking
very
Kiss t-shirt?"
Unprofessional cussing like that. If that actually happened, that's super unprofessional. But okay, go ahead.
So that's what happened, bro. And I'm saying it now. So
tell me.
That's what happened. And I said, "John," and you know what really happened, Chavo, is I said, "John, I just put it on. I'm sorry." And the reason I said that, man, is because he caught me off guard and he called me out right in front of Carano and Dunn. And I was like, holy shit.
And he's your boss. So I get it. Yeah.
He's my boss. So I was like, "Oh, John," I said, "I apologize." I said, "I just put it on." I said, "I'll go change now." I said, you know, oh shit. So at the time when that happened, I walked away and I was thinking, I was like, "Oh my God, I'm going to get suspended for 30 days without pay. Oh my God, he's going to fine me $1,000. So I was mentally prepared for that.
Right.
I didn't know that as I walked away. And the reason I found this out is because Jericho went to confront Johnny about it the Friday, the Monday after at TV, after they fired me. So what happened was, what transpired is that after I walked away, Kevin Dunn turned to Johnny and says, "Marty just fucking lied to you. What are you going to do about it?" And Johnny says, "I'll take care of it." And Kevin says, "You need to fire him because WWE doesn't need fucking liars like that."
Why did you, what did they think you lied about?
I denied wearing the Kiss t-shirt because they'd seen me. They'd seen me in the, in the valet. Right. So when Johnny goes, "What are you doing? Where?" "Oh, sorry, John. I just put it on. I'll take it off." You know, that's what it was. So I lied to an executive, is what Kevin Dunn said.
Gotcha.
So, and even though a couple months prior to that, I had worked the greatest match in WrestleMania history.
Right.
Go figure. You know,
well, I know that some people, especially, I mean, any business, but they're for sure, you know, some people get away with things and some people couldn't.
Yeah.
There was
different strokes, different folks.
Definitely favoritism for sure. You know, some people would get fined for this, something like that. Some people wouldn't, you know.
Yeah. And to me, it was a political thing.
Yeah. They made it, it was the main example. Sure.
Made an example of me, but you know, the thing, knowing what I know now and where I'm at today in life and career and stuff like that, it was just somebody stroking their dick and showing how big their dick was. Well, sure. That's all it was, man. And you know, I get that. I get that. But you didn't have to take away somebody's livelihood just to prove a point, man.
Right.
And I get that, man. And I look back at stuff today, and especially that situation and stuff. That was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. By those guys firing me and letting me go, I was able to go and transition into what I'm doing today. And
right.
Even though it sucked and it was the worst thing at the time, it didn't kill me. And it just made me better at what I did. And then I was able to go do different things, but it blows me away that things like this occur. And there's nothing that you can really do about it, because it all goes back to politics. It goes back to, you know, people trying to prove that, you know, that they have a certain authority or they can do this or they can do that.
Right.
But at the end of the day, I mean, what people don't really look at is, like, you know, you're taking somebody's livelihood away just to prove a point.
No, yeah, for sure. There's other consequences of that. And I get it. That's a tough one to even... Yeah. You know, even to try to decipher it, it sucks that it happened.
Yeah.
It happened,
but it happened.
From there, you know, you go from WWE, and next, you know, now we're in, like, I mean, this is, can you give it a little bit of time, and then we end up in Lucha Underground, a place that we're kind of trying to change wrestling, the landscape of wrestling. I think
we did, man. I honestly feel that the position that AEW is right now, or the TV deal and all the other stuff that they got, that should have been Lucha Underground. You know, Lucha Underground should have been in that second position and stuff, you know, but, you know, well, shit happens, man.
Yeah. Yeah. So Lucha Underground, it was a Mark Burnett production, who does Survivor and, you know, and a bunch of other big old shows. And we were on the Robert Rodriguez network called El Rey.
Yeah.
And none of us really knew what it was going to be at first. And it turns out to be a TV show about wrestling, in a sense.
Underground.
Yeah, it's a wrestling show, but disguised in a TV show. And really, what I loved about it is that we kind of did things so different, you know, by doing backstage, not just promos. We did, like, backstage, like, acting scenes and different things like that. And we really changed the landscape of wrestling. And then to have the big guys start copying stuff that we did was really, it's flattering. It's, you know, the form of serious, the serious form of flattery is imitation, something like that. I don't know. Anyways, but
imitation is the biggest form of flattery.
There you go. That's what I was trying to say. But definitely that's it was a huge compliment for sure. But I miss Lucha Underground so much, because I thought we had so much potential. And just, it's like, God, there's so many, you know, that's to me, it's one of those cases. There was too many chiefs and not enough Indians, and not to be political like that, but seriously, like, there was too many people trying to be the boss and not trying to do what was right for the company, you know?
Yeah. And you know, it was great, Chavo, because we had such a core group of guys who were really running that whole thing, man. It was you, me, Joseph, Eric, Tony, Conan, and stuff. And I remember every morning, dude, we would always come in and we would always go into those creative meetings and we would, right. we would start just getting throwing stuff ideas, going, man, throwing yeah. ideas and just, you know, being creative and what about this and that. And we would and sit look, there and go and over look the scripts. The rest, and,
look at the wrestlers that came out from that, you know, Pentagon, yeah. Phoenix, Brian Cage, Willie Mack, you know, Taya,
Prince Puma,
Prince Puma, Ricochet. God, there were so many.
Mil Muertes. Mil
Muertes. Yeah, yeah. Ricky Banderas. God, there were so many people that came out of there that were just are now sometimes at the top of wrestling right now. So it was really cool to see that.
And you know what I love to say, Chavo, is that we made those stars.
Yeah.
You know we developed those stars.
I like to say that we had a hand in polishing them because they're already stars. These guys were already awesome. We had a hand in helping them a little bit get to where they needed to be. But God, these guys when I first saw these guys, I was like, wow, these guys are really, really good.
Yeah. And you know, what's crazy about that is that I remember that we had asked for specific people from AAA and stuff. And right. those are the folks that they gave us. And all of a sudden, you know, once they got to Lucha and stuff, it was like, boom, yeah, they sky's the limit. Yeah.
Well, I saw how good these guys could be and how, you know, act with a little guidance, what these guys could actually do. And now they take the ball and run with it, you know?
Yeah, man. And you know, it was great being a part of that, man, because right. just the work and like you said, the way they shot stuff and, you know, with Skip Chase and doing what he was doing with all the vignettes and stuff and just right. the way it was shot. It wasn't like a normal, you know, television show. It was shot completely different. It was it had like that grime.
Book.
Yeah.
Shot like a comic book. I was in the room sometimes when we'd be colorizing the actual film, what the footage and colorizing it to maybe look more like dirty and gritty and stuff. So it was really cool to see that. Yeah.
Yeah, man. I miss it. I miss it. I really do.
I think the wrestling fans miss it too. But then from there, we were doing kind of two at once and went from Lucha Underground. And I had got a call from this Netflix TV show called Glow and needed a ring guy and needed a ring technician. I go, hey, what are you doing? Come on over.
Yeah. Thank you for that. You know, that was amazing.
Right. Well, how good was that? We went from like learning from WWE to Lucha Underground, learning in, you know, the TV business and then going to really learn the TV business with Glow. That's pretty amazing, right?
Yeah. And it was cool to be able to transition. And like I said, you know, getting fired from WWE was probably one of the coolest things that ever happened to me in hindsight, because I was able to go from that situation and go into Lucha Underground. But then, you know, real quick, Chavo, after I got released from WWE, I went back and I worked a normal job for about a year and stuff. And then I said, no way, man, I got back into rock and roll and stuff. And then I started going out and I started doing touring and all that other stuff, you know, with all these different bands. And then, you know, kind of transitioned and the Lucha Underground thing happened and then, you know, Glow and stuff. So it was a transition that happened for me. And it was an amazing, you know, time to be like, wow, you know, I don't need WWE.
You know what? It's funny because I remember running into you at an indie show in Denver and you were there doing a concert for somebody. And then you came to the show and like, you're like, hey, Chavo, hey, Mario, what's up? And you're like, you were doing concert stuff for some band. And I was like, oh, awesome. So
I was out on the Mayhem Festival, dude.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of which, you had another life before wrestling. If anybody doesn't know, Marty was a huge rocker from back in the day. And this guy was was a regular back at the Whiskey and the Palladium and all those places in Hollywood, right?
The Roxy, the Troubadour, Gazzari's. Wow. You know, I seen Motley Crue in 81. I mean, I was 15 years old when I hitchhiked to see Motley for the first time. And they just did something to me. And I said, this is my band. And even though I was a huge Kiss fan and stuff, you know, I really took a liking to Motley Crue and embraced what they were doing because they were raw. They were young. They didn't give a shit. And, you know, it was like, you know, we're going to make it. And, you know, I mean, seeing Motley back in the clubs in 81, 82 and stuff before they got signed and before they blew up. I mean, these guys were on fire, man. And these guys were just killing it all the time. And, you know, to see Motley go from the clubs and really get out there handing flyers out and stuff, which right. I still have a lot of the flyers that I got personally being out there in front of the Rainbow and the Roxy and stuff. And Guns N' Roses were out there. Poison were out there. The Warrant guys were out there. I mean, it was just such a cool vibe. And, you know, you had David Lee Roth, who was always at the Troubadour or the Roxy and stuff, you know, so all these guys was there and I was actually right in the middle of it. And I remember I worked for a band called Blitzkrieg in 84, 85 and Ron Keel had produced their record and stuff. And I was their drum roadie and everything. So I would set up all the drums and I would, you know, go travel with them and stuff, you know, so I was doing all that in the '80s and a part of that. And I always like to tell people that wrestling just kind of happened for me.
Right. Well, sometimes rock and roll and wrestling kind of go hand in hand, you know, you'd like one.
Yeah,
like
they both. Do.
But that's pretty cool. I mean, the Whiskey, anybody knows the Whiskey a Go-Go, any LA band started out at the Whiskey. I mean, the Doors, Van Halen, you know, Motley Crue.
Rat.
Yeah. No Doubt. They all played there. That was it's such a small little, you're right. Small. You're on top of the people there. It's crazy. It's really.
Yeah. Remember when you and I and Ricky went to see Fozzy there?
Yeah, so we went one time and went and saw Chris Jericho's band Fozzy, and we were up in the dressing room with them, and I was looking around the dressing room going, God, the stories this room can tell, because anybody, that's where every band, there's only one room to train it, to dress in, and every band that ever has gone through there has dressed up there, and we were drinking, you know, some vodka with Jericho back up there, and that was pretty, I mean, I was like nostalgia
it was
right
fun.
There, you know?
Yeah, and it was funny because that was Ricky's first time on the Sunset Strip and the Whiskey and stuff. And I'm, oh, bro, this is awesome, bro. Yeah, bro. You know?
Yeah. That's pretty. That's crazy, man.
It was fun, man.
The Whiskey, man. So you go from being a rocker to the wrestling, man. What's up now? Like, who's the best bands out now? Because I know you have some favorites, but you know, I'm kind of
the Struts.
Oh yeah. The Struts for sure.
That's the Struts.
The singer is that's like true, like rock star right there. Right.
Yeah. Luke Spiller, man. Luke Spiller is the real deal, man. As a matter of fact, Struts just released, they just dropped a new single last Friday called Low Key in Love. And it's cool because they're expanding and doing different things, getting more mainstream. And it's a duet with Michael Jackson's daughter, Paris Jackson. It's called Low Key in Love. Yeah, great tune, man. Great video, great vibe. You know, and it's funny because the Struts are like my band right now, even though I'm a big Motley guy and Kiss and all that. But the Struts are my guys right now and really love that band, really have gotten into them. And, you know, it's cool because I have a relationship with those guys. You know, I got a relationship with Luke Spiller, man. And, you the Struts, their music literally saved my life. You know, it really saved my life at a low point that I had a few years back. But, you know, again, music is so powerful, man. And that's why when I have things going on or whatever, I always turn to music because music is something that I could resonate and go back to and really be inspired or just picked up or just be motivated by it and everything. So I don't care what walk of life you come from, you like some form of music. And right now, you know, my guys are the Struts and awesome. Hey, Luke.
No, that's awesome. No, it's cool. You know, I got to start get into those guys. I just heard Wolfgang Van Halen's new stuff.
Yeah.
Wow. That guy's dude. The prodigy, man. He plays all the instruments. The guy's so good. You know, I'm torn with Van Halen as a bassist, and I thought he was just a bass guy. Now he plays, you know, drums and plays piano and plays guitar, and he sings, and he's like so good. Like,
dude, you know what's, you know, speaking of music and stuff, so me being a rocker guy and all that, my holy grail guitar pick, because I collected guitar picks throughout the years and stuff.
Right.
Even when I was at WWE, my holy grail is a 1981 Fair Warning Eddie Van Halen guitar pick.
Oh, you have one?
Oh, absolutely. Wow. Absolutely. Yeah, that's like my holy grail, dude. The 81 Van Halen Fair Warning Tour, Eddie Van Halen guitar pick. Thank you know, you. It's cool because I got all of Eddie's picks from early 80s all the way through the 80s, all the way through the 90s and the 2000s and stuff. So the Eddie Van Halens are my holy grails and stuff. And those are like under lock and key because it was King Edward. And sadly, you know, he's no longer with us, you know, which hurts, you know,
Huge loss. In the rock and roll world. I mean, the best guitarist of all time.
You know, man.
Arguably the best, but.
Yeah, you know, like I tell people, you know, he'll be my guitar player for the rest of my life. He was the guitar player of my lifetime. You know, there'll never be anybody like that, man. And it was cool because I got to see Van Halen numerous times, and I was fortunate that I got to meet Eddie three times. So it was awesome.
Wow. Did you ever see him at the Whiskey? Where'd you see him at, the smallest venue?
Smallest venue I ever seen him at was, I want to say it was Gazzari's.
I've seen those guys.
And no, actually, you know, I take that back. Orange Pavilion. I take that back. Pavilion in San Bernardino. Because I'm thinking Motley. So
Right.
Yeah. Orange Pavilion. Yeah. So it was cool, man, because I mean, back then, I mean, it was like 82, 83 or whatever, you know, Van Halen was doing different things. And, you know, it was crazy to see them. As a matter of fact, I seen those guys, the Form, I seen them, God, dude, just all these different places in LA.
Wow. That's so awesome. Now you've been kind of everywhere because with, you know, being touring with bands and seeing bands and being on the road with wrestling, what's your favorite city to visit or to work in, you know?
Tokyo, Japan.
Tokyo. Yeah. I love Japan. I don't know if you're going to say something in Germany or if you're going to say something in Japan or what you're going to say, but Tokyo, man, what do you like about Tokyo?
I just love the enthusiasm of the crowd. And, you know, I, as a big music fan,
right.
Tokyo and especially Japan always had the greatest vinyl and the best music stores, man. And I remember
when me and Chris Jericho, we'd be traveling in Japan, you know, before all the internet and all that stuff, we would go looking because his thing was, you know, music too. We'd go looking at all these underground vinyl places.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was cool because anytime me and Jericho were there together, Masa would always take us to a place called Ayers, and we would always go and stuff. And dude, you could find everything and anything at Ayers in Tokyo. And it was cool because Ayers was so famous within the rock and roll world, and it was an underground thing, is that Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin actually went to Ayers to get footage, rare bootleg Led Zeppelin footage, because Ayers had it. Yeah. Wow. So that's how deep these guys were, man.
Dude, that's awesome. That's one of my favorite cities too, man. I love Tokyo. Yeah. Just so many different things. Roppongi, go down to Roppongi.
Woo!
Culture, the people, the KO Plaza, you know, all the places. Yeah. I mean, I love that for sure. Man, we're getting close to being up close to an hour on here, but I do something on Suplex and Cervezas called rapid fire. This is rapid fire questions that I kind of shoot at you, and there's no right or wrong. It's just for your fans to kind of know a little bit more about you. Are you game?
Sure.
Yeah. All right, man.
Let's go, brother.
All right. So we'll go through some genres. Were you back in the day, were you an NWA fan or a WWF fan?
Both. I was both. Because I appreciated NWA because those guys were more workers.
Sure.
Those guys worked.
They were the workers.
Yeah. So WWF back then to me was more of the bubblegum type thing with the Hogans and all the other stuff and all that.
Right. Sure.
Whereas the NWA, the Flares, all the Road Warriors and all that, those guys were the workers. Dusty.
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff, you know, so I it was a combination of both. And the reason I say that is because my little brothers were always into the WWF stuff because they were kids. And, you know, so you watch that.
Right.
But the purist and stuff in me was always the NWA stuff, watching all that other old school stuff. So it was a combination of both.
For sure. Okay. Me being an ex-80s rocker guy too. Were you a Judas Priest fan or Iron Maiden fan?
Judas Priest.
I'm a Priest guy too. You know, Maiden was sometimes just too heavy for me back then. You know, I was just, for some reason, I just love Judas Priest.
And dude, it's fun. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. It's so funny when people talk about, oh, back then, you know, we would fight anybody who said, like, you know, oh, well, Rob Halford, he's gay. And we're like, no, he's not. Oh my God, no way. Now I look back at it going, oh my God, look at his dress. He was from the Blue Oyster, man. Like, so. Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's cool, Chavo, you mentioned Judas Priest and Rob Halford.
There's nothing wrong with that, just back then
no
different climate for sure.
Yeah, But you know, it's cool, dude, being in the rock and roll world and stuff and everything. I've actually got to work with Rob Halford, dude. I actually got to be his driver and stuff for a few events that I've worked in, Revolver, Golden Gods, and all these other stuff, you know. So I've been really blessed, man, to be a part of the rock and roll world as well, man. So I've got to work with Rob, and he's such a sweetheart and stuff. I remember I showed up late because of traffic, LA traffic and stuff. And I had to pick him up. So I went to his hotel and went and got him and stuff, went up to his room and got him. And I apologized for being late. And he goes, "Don't worry about it, mate. It's rock and roll. This is what we do." Okay.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's cool. Awesome. All right. So were you a Ric Flair fan or Hulk Hogan fan?
Ric Flair, brother.
Ooh,
woo, woo. And you know what's so cool, dude? Seeing Flair back then, before I worked with him, before I knew him and stuff like that, dude, it was so cool to finally be able to work with him and to get to party with him. Yeah. And was another thing too, that when you partied with the champ, dude, you partied with the champ.
No, for sure. For sure. I had to steal a bunch of bar tabs from him just to pay him, because he'd never let me pay. He'd always pay everything. So
no,
that's his thing.
That's his thing, dude. And it was crazy, because he would actually get upset if you tried to pay the tab.
Yeah. Oh no, for sure.
Yeah. Totally. And you know, it was cool. But one of the cool memories that I have working with Flair, dude, is we were over in Europe, and I just found out that my dad was in a coma. I was over on tour. And my dad had been in the hospital and stuff.
Your dad was an OG. He was from
brother.
He was OG, brother. Homie.
Oh, he was, brother. Deep, deep, deep. So he was in a coma, and I just found out. And I was working. We were in Manchester, England, and I was working. And again, this goes back to being able to work with all the greats and stuff, and having those opportunities. It was Piper and Flair as a tag team champs against the Spirit Squad.
Oh, wow.
And wow. Yeah, dude, talk about amazing. So Flair's making his entrance and everything and all that. Mm-hmm. And of course, you always go hold the ropes for the champ and stuff. Right. So as I go over to hold the ropes open for the champ, Rick is getting in. And as he's getting in between the ropes and stuff, he goes, "I'm sorry to hear about your dad, kid."
Oh, man.
Got goosebumps, dude.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That's much love for Flair.
Yeah, I know, for sure. For sure. And for Roddy, too.
Yeah.
So were you a Rick Steamboat or Randy Macho Man Savage?
I'm a Steamboat guy, dude.
Steamboat.
Steamboat guy. Totally. Steamboat. There's just something about Steamboat, dude, that which I like to feel that he helped me a lot with this, dude, is you're able to flow, dude. There was nothing rigid about Ricky Steamboat and the way he worked and stuff. He was just smooth and fluid. And like Steamboat would always say, flow like water, flow like water. Yeah, you know, your steps, your movements and stuff. So Steamboat is Flair. Of course, you know, I love Hogan too, because I was able to work with Hulk Hogan too.
No, yeah. No, so this is no right or wrong answer. Just, you know, this is, I get it.
Steamboat.
Blondes or brunettes?
Brunettes.
Boom.
Yeah.
Are you a vintage car fan, a classic car, or a new car guy?
I love old Mustangs, man.
Yeah.
Old Corvettes. Too. Yeah.
Yeah. Something about them. They got they have so much character, right?
Yeah. My dream car is a hard top 1967 Cherry custom Mustang. That's my dream car. Yeah.
Love it. You like baseball? Are you a Los Angeles Dodgers or a Los Angeles Angel fan?
Angel fan. Love Angels. Baseball. Yeah. Dude, I played baseball in high school, and I was pretty good, you know? And again, it goes back to being an athlete and being able to do stuff. Man, I played semi-pro up until the time I was like 23 years old, man.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so I love baseball, and I'm glad baseball's back. Matter of fact, this afternoon, I'm going to watch my nephew who plays. Oh, nice. So love going out there.
Baseball's back. I got to make myself out to an Angel game here soon.
Dude, we got to go.
Yeah.
Got to go.
I'm down. This is, I always ask anybody in the wrestling business this question. Waffle House or Cracker Barrel?
Waffle House, brother.
Waffle, yeah.
Scrambled eggs and toast, bro.
Smothered, covered, and crumbled, whatever they're called with the hash browns.
Dude, Waffle House. I mean, if you've never experienced a Waffle House, man, you need to do that, because those were literally the only things that were open at 3 o'clock in the morning when we were driving 600 miles, you know?
No, totally. And that's why I always ask that question, because if we could get a Cracker Barrel in the morning, then great. But so many times we were just like, you know, at you know, 4 a.m. just trying to get some food, and you get a Waffle House and you're like, oh, thank God, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was funny because you would walk in, man, and the cooks and the waitresses, are, what's your order? You know, smoking and taking the order, and you just go, okay. You know, you there?
Yeah. Okay. There you're back. You're back. Okay. You froze for a second. No big deal. We'll edit that.
Yeah,
out.
You too.
Okay. No big deal. Yeah. Waffle House for sure though. Okay. So this is the holy grail of questions for you. Are you sure. A Motley Crue or Kiss fan?
Motley Crue.
Wow. Over Kiss. Get out of here.
Over Kiss. Yeah. And the reason being is because Kiss was already established and everything in 77. Sure. And of course in 76, when I first got turned on to Kiss, they were larger than life. They were, right. Oh my God. But when I got to see Motley Crue, I was 15 years old and I was starting out. I was already getting into trouble. I was already, you know, a rebel, and life at home was dysfunctional and all this other shit. Right. So for me, Kiss was more, especially like towards 77, 79, is they were more oriented to the younger kids and flashy and Super Kiss and the costumes and all that. Whereas when Motley came out in 81, they were raw. They were hungry. They were nasty. They really didn't give a fuck, man. And I was a 15-year-old kid.
Yeah, you grew with them.
Yeah.
Grew
up with them, man. And as a matter of fact,
you grew up with Motley Crue. So yeah. And they grew up with you. So yeah, I get it. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. So I, you there? Yeah, so I I actually have Motley Crue tattooed on my leg.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Steve Richards has it on his arm.
Yeah, so I got Nikki Sixx and Mick Mars' autograph tattooed on my leg, you know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I have that tattooed on my leg and stuff because, you know, those guys, like you said, they're the soundtrack of my life and stuff. And, you know, I was influenced by a lot of the things that they did and stuff. And, you know, and here's the thing that I'll tell you. When I was on the road with WWE, I was touring. I was doing what I wanted to do, because when I was 10 years old, I wanted to tour. I wanted to be in a rock band. I couldn't do that. So when I finally got on the road and stuff, I said, you know what? I'm not touring rock and roll, but I am on tour. I am going to different cities, different countries, and I'm on the road for 2 weeks at a time or whatever. So I said, you know what? I'm going to party like Motley Crue. And that's what I did. You know?
Yeah.
And
that's dangerous.
It was dangerous, man. And there was many a times where I went, oh my God, why am I doing this? But you know, dude, I was in Motley mode and I was like, I'm on the road, right. I'm doing this. But again, I never did the partying where I hurt anybody or I had anybody do anything stupid, or whatever.
Sure.
When I was partying, I did the partying for myself. And a lot of times I did it privately, you know, where I just went off and did my own thing and stuff, but I was whatever, you know, Motley Crue.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally. Would you, that you saw Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses come up too. Are you still a Crue fan over Roses or GNR?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, man. Definitely. Yeah. As a matter of fact, dude, you know, the last 4 years I've been working backline for Vince Neil, you know, his solo band.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So
oh, yeah, cool.
Dude, you know, get that out there. Good. Yeah. Yeah, man. Talk about coming full circle, man. I mean, you know, being able to work with Vince and be on stage with Vince, you know, on the side of the stage, him singing Dr. Feelgood, Livewire and stuff like that. You talk about That's a awesome. Fucking surreal trip, dude, that, oh my God, I was 15 years old when I seen you and I get to work with you now, man. And I get to be on stage with you and you're singing these songs cool. that resonated, dude. It's fucking surreal, dude. But again, it's like, if you have dreams and you have ambition and you have drive, dude, go do whatever the fuck you want to do, man. You know, like don't become a victim to any one business, man, whether it be wrestling or whatever, dude, go out and do whatever the fuck you're going to do and do it well.
I agree with you. There's times that I'm doing stuff with like Mike Tyson now and stuff. And I remember watching Tyson fight, you know, and being such a big fan of his. Wow. You know, as a kid and go, gee, and now I'm, you know, hey, Mike, hey, Chavo, you know, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Surreal,
so,
huh, man?
Where can anybody, Yeah, no, it is, man, for sure. For sure, man. It's cool. Life, you know, the life is a cool roller coaster. So it's a ride, man. It's a marathon, yeah. Not a sprint. So
absolutely.
Right. Where can anybody find you now, man? Where can they find you on social media and what you're doing?
Oh, dude, I'm so low key now, especially when it comes to professional wrestling, bro. The only thing, I don't even watch it or nothing, but people can find me. Right. The only social media that I have is Instagram, and it's Marty underscore Elias underscore one. And that's the only thing that I have. I don't have a Facebook. I don't have a Twitter. I don't have a TikTok. I don't have a website. I just keep it real. And I have social media just to entertain myself and to make it something, you know, that people can go and be motivated by. My social media, I like to make it appealing, dude. I really do. No, all the negativity that's in the world and all that, you know, it's one of those things. So it's there. But I will say this, man, you know, that I actually am doing an appearance May 14th and 15th for Squared Circle Expo in Indianapolis, Indiana. So
awesome.
Kind of getting back into the wrestling thing for a little bit, because, you know, it's funny, because as much as you don't want to be a part of something or you moved on, whatever, it's still kind of, it's there whether you like it or not. And I'll always be a part of it, which I'm grateful for. So I just booked that, and man, it's
love
been
those
great.
Things, dude. I love those WrestleCons and those, you know, anytime I get to meet fans like that and see people that are big fans, I just love meeting people like that. It's a lot of fun talking to them, getting to know their story, and, you know, kind of interacting with them. That's something that I really do like.
Yeah,
I thank you so much for jumping on with me today.
No, thank you, man. I appreciate it.